we're going to break it down for you frame by frame, because you're listening to America's most meticulous podcast, The Pod People. I'm the hash man, Matisse Van Rossum.
I'm the bad egg, Ben Sheets.
And I'm Cleveland Mosier, but tonight you can call me Ray Harryhausen, because I'm housing these beers. And you can also call me Phil Tippett, because I'm tipping them back. I'm getting drunk tonight, boys.
Well, look at you, getting drunk on a Thursday.
Getting drunk on a Thursday.
Getting drunk on a Thursday. We're back to talk about the new film, Stop Motion, the feature-length directorial debut of acclaimed stop-motion animator Robert Morgan. I was surprised to see that he's been around and making shorts since, like, the mid-90s.
Really?
Yeah, believe it or not. I think his first short came out in, like, 1994. I'm not sure how old he was at the time. But, yeah, he's been on the scene for a hot minute, and it's hard to believe that it took him 30 years to make his first feature film. But he did. It's out, and we saw it.
Yeah, and it was pretty good, actually.
And it was pretty good. Well, I remember when you posted the trailer, and before I clicked on it, I was like, okay, Robert Morgan, like, I'm expecting the whole thing to be animated, sure, right? Like, I was expecting a Mad God-type scenario.
But instead, it's more of a Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Precisely. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. But no, it's a really solid blend of live action and stop motion. I would say primarily it's a live action film,
sure,
but it is also, you know, very meta. It's about the act, the process of making stop motion animation, and the toll, the creative toll that it takes upon one's life and sanity and blah blah blah. It's another one of those I suffer for my art movies.
Yes.
Yeah, but one of the better done ones, I will say.
From a technical level, I totally agree.
Yeah, you know, Robert Morgan, for people who aren't aware, he did a few really notable short films. He did Bobby Yeah.
I think that's the big one that people would know.
And The Cat with Hands is also pretty well regarded.
And he also did a segment in the ABCs of Death 2.
Oh. I haven't seen that
For the fans of those classic acclaimed films.
Big ABC heads.
For babies who like the alphabet.
Baby Einstein over here. Those were his two big, you know, kind of shorts. And to see him kind of move on to a feature length, I was a bit nervous because, like, how do you sustain something like a Bobby Yeah for a feature film?
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is that he didn't.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I think it was smart of him not to.
Yeah.
Because, like, his stop-motion animation style is just kind of viscerally upsetting to look at.
Yeah.
Like, texturally, it's really nasty.
By design.
And grotesque. And to kind of pair it with live action, you know, it keeps it from being just overwhelmingly.
Well, yeah, that's kind of why I was a little bit worried initially about, you know, us getting a Mad God scenario. Because, you know, when we talked about that movie, almost a couple years ago now, like, I think we all kind of agreed that, like, despite what a miraculous, like, technical achievement it was, that, like, it kind of felt like it was lacking something in terms of, like, narrative and substance.
It didn't feel like it was grounded.
Yeah.
You know? And, like, by making so much of this one live action, it really grounds kind of the more abstract elements of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that balance a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think some credit to Mad God. Like, it is about a world constructed by a mad god. You know, things aren't supposed to make sense and the rest. But still, to agree with you guys in full, I do find that less satisfying.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, like, to be clear, Mad God...
It's more objective.
Mad God makes sense. There's just not a lot happening in it. It's just kind of, you know, moving from one tableau to the next and, like, just giving you that a chance to, like, take in and absorb the world, which, you know, is cool and fun, but not necessarily engaging, I guess. Not always. And I think this movie avoids that. Also, just because, like, Robert Morgan's other stuff, like, I haven't seen all of it, but typically it's dialogue-less.
Yeah, I mean, The Cat with Hands has, like, that little bit of intro where they're starting to tell the story.
Right.
But very minimal.
Which, you know, for a short, I think is quite clever, because I'm sure that those were made with pretty controlled budgets and, you know, on a small scale. And in that circumstance, you want to play to your strengths. His strength is clearly stop motion, and that is that is center and full in those sequences. So voice acting, performances, these are all things that, if not done well on a small budget, can weigh you down. So I think, as someone who's worked on a lot of small projects myself, like, I have a lot of respect for that. I have a lot of respect for, like, just really focusing on what you know you can do right and letting that shine and not be detracted by other things.
And also, to be clear, like, stop motion is probably the most time-intensive form of animation, and, like, there's a reason why it took Phil Tippett 30 years to make Mad God.
Yeah.
It takes a long time. It's very meticulous. It's very slow.
Or it's hard to make.
Yeah, it is. And so I think that the way he approached this film structurally was pretty smart.
Yeah. Well, let's just very briefly, like, cover the plot. So it's about this woman, Ella.
She's played by Aisling Franciosi, I think is her name.
Lead in The Nightingale.
She's the lead in The Nightingale. She's in Boat Dracula. So we've talked about her a couple times. She's very, very good in this.
Yeah.
A highlight performance, I think. Relatively small cast.
Minimal locations also. I think that the budget of this film is really well handled. I was looking at the credits, and not 100%, but it looks to me like the funding for this movie was built around UK grants, which makes a great deal of sense to me. A lot of my favorite artists and directors, I've been looking into that a lot lately, you know, like how, like, some of these greater artists get their funding outside of Hollywood.
That's pretty typical for most countries outside of the United States,
correct,
where their film industries are much smaller and have less money. Like, most of those movies are made with art grants from
my
the
favorite
government.
Example. Exactly, and that's why I thought it was, like, this is a good opportunity.
You see, yeah, you see it a lot. You see it a lot in Canadian films, British films, Australian films, very big.
Primarily, Canadian films. Being the works of
David Cronenberg.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, who we've covered a lot on the podcast, and that's had me thinking a lot about, like, how does art like David Cronenberg's film like films get made? And it's grants, you know, for so many of those pieces, it has to be government funding, because it's about nurturing the art and the culture. Which is still seen as something that is worth funding for the public interest, which instead of just for, capital gain. So that's just...
Go off, King!
I am. I'm going off. I've been thinking about that a lot lately. No reason. But, yeah.
Well, let's get back to the plot really quick. So it starts Ella, who is helping her elderly mother finish her final stop motion film. Her mother is a famous stop motion animator, and as she's come to old age, she's started getting, you know, shaky hands.
She has bad arthritis.
Yeah.
The joints in her hands are very swollen, and her hands are kind of locked in claws.
Yeah.
Like you see with old people with really bad arthritis. So she's not able to make her films herself. Mm-hmm. So she has to enlist her daughter as her hands. She's the brain, Ella's the hands.
She literally calls her puppet throughout the movie, which...
The traditional British puppet, you know.
Like in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Exactly. And so Ella is kind of creatively stifled. She wants to get out from under her mom so she can become her own person, realize her own dreams as an artist.
What I like about this movie, unlike other films, sorry to cut you off, but just to kind of aim in on that, what I really like about that is in most of these types of films, the artist already has dreams and visions and plans outside of that, and they're trying to get out from whatever is keeping them from enacting those dreams, visions, and plans, whether it be society, their parents, whatever, right? Like, whatever obstacles that are in their path. Here, it's even worse, because in one of the first scenes of the film, her mother asks her, what do you want to make? How would you do it? What would you do? And she has no answer.
Yeah.
She answers her mother with silence, and I find that really compelling. She still has that same need to go and create her own thing, but she doesn't know what that means. She's a girl lost in the woods.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, literally. but I do think, I will say, like, this isn't necessarily, like, a novel approach to this type of story.
No.
Plenty of stories and films made about creatively stifled artists who are seeking an inspiration that...
A muse
that cannot be found, you know, usually, especially in, like, the horror art films, they find their muse through some kind of violence or darkness or depravity or something.
Just what certainly does.
Which it does, although I will agree with you where I think what's kind of interesting about this film is that, like, even by the end, I don't know if she ever really finds her creative voice. Like, she does create something, but ends up just being completely consumed by it.
I feel like that's part of the creative process.
I kind of agree too that, you know, by the end of it, you've released this thing from yourself. You know, it's not something you keep with you, or you should. But you know, the film untethers reality from the top. I think it that allows it to just operate as allegory. Like the whole film can just exist as a parable, as a metaphor, and also in that. Because of that, it doesn't really matter, and if it does, then the film itself is the art she created, right? Like, and you know, by the end, like that, there's that whole really long stop motion sequence that comes out of her. I think in it with the whole egg and the inspiration thing and all that, like, I think it all plays in.
But I don't think she ever really maybe we're jumping too far ahead, but I don't think she ever really finds true inspiration, though, is what I'm saying. Like, I think she more just gives form to her anxieties and lets them consume her. Like, she gives shape to that. Like, she doesn't find something that... She doesn't ever have, like, a sort of moment of eureka, an aha. Like, now I'm inspired and I know what to do. Like, the art always creates itself for her, right? Like, she does it all in fugue states, right?
Well, it controls she's her. She's the puppet.
Right, exactly. She's the puppet. She's never in control of what is coming out of her, and every chunk of the film that she is gradually creating over time always happens in a fugue state that she doesn't remember. She always wakes up the next day and sees the next bit of the film that she has created. So where it doesn't feel like she is the creator, right? Like, she's the puppet, like you said.
Yeah. But, well, what I find interesting about that is, like, the whole conceit is, like, her quote-unquote neighbor is this young girl who comes in and starts dictating the story to her, and it's very clear, like, that's supposed to be like a stand-in for her childhood childhood creativity. And like, I like the idea of, like, your youthful creativity takes the reins of a creative work to the point where you don't feel like you're inputting as much as, like, your raw id is,
right?
And so I feel like the inspiration is there. It's coming from within her, but she doesn't really feel ownership of it because...
Sure.
And by making it a cautionary tale, as opposed to a story of triumph, it also highlights something that I find to be sort of personally quite important, is that, like, you know, the art's more important than the artist, you know, in so many of these circumstances. Like, it's not about her. It's about what she's made. And that she does do to her own ruin, yes. And such is life in the fucking crypt. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I
sure.
maybe that's a bit of a black pill take. You know, maybe that's a little dark. But I do think that there is something to that. I mean, so many of my favorite works are love letters to other great artists. It takes a lot of people to build a cathedral, you know, to build a pyramid, and often a lot of harm and suffering and pain to make something great. And that's not a justification or a condemnation, but you need that to live, to build, to create. And you avoid it where you can, but it is something that, like, I think that many artists carry with them. I think so much of all artists, Miyazaki's work actually touches on this a great deal. Herzog also. So it's something I've been thinking about a lot lately, but it's something that films don't often touch on, is that art is just this beautiful, great creative process, but no, it often takes much out of artists.
It's a compulsion. You talk about, yes, Herzog, and like, I just finished reading Herzog on Herzog recently, and what he talks a lot about in that is the driving need to keep making films.
Yes.
That he feels not like an artist, but an artisan, and that what he's creating is his duty.
Yes.
He talks about that a lot, that, mm-hmm, it's his duty to make films.
I couldn't agree more.
Not necessarily that he wants to, or that he even enjoys it, which of course he does, but that he has this need to, yeah, this responsibility to tell these stories.
I talk to my artist friends about this a lot, like my other painter friends, and I've never heard anyone disagree with this. Like, everyone, like, it's a pretty universal feeling that when we step away from our art for a while, and we step away from drawing or painting, we go on a vacation, we go on a holiday or whatever, if you don't draw for a little while, you start to twitch, you start to get a little upset. To me, it's no different from a beaver's building dams, you know, from bees making honeycombs. It's just what I was made to do. It's in my fucking bones, man. And, you know, both my parents are artists, so I kind of grew up in that. But I've been doing it since I was a kid. And frankly, too, it's a pretty competitive industry. And it always has been. And to do well, to make a living, you have to do it all the time. And it requires a great deal of sacrifice. One last parable, and then I'll kind of sit back and let you guys talk for a little bit. But one of the key examples of that in history is Michelangelo. Who was pretty disturbed, he had a lot of problems, but I think it relates to this film very similarly, that when Michelangelo was carving, I believe this account was from when he was doing the David, but one of his interns or servants kept a record, and they said that he had designed a shower system that had served two purposes, and one was to keep the dust down, and the other was to keep him hydrated, so he could just do it for days at a time. And they said that when he finally sat down after, you know, days of working on this thing and dedication, he went to take his boots off, and the first several layers of skin just came with them.
Gross.
Vile, right? But how relevant is that, you know, to this,
yeah,
film?
And, yeah.
And that to create something that happens, I've certainly, like, over the past few years, like, I, you know, my body has, you know, I haven't taken as good care of it because I've been so busy working and putting in time. And things suffer around you, you know, life gathers rust, and you have to be really careful of that, but it's a balance.
That's not unique to art, that's any job.
That's any career, it's true.
See, well, and that's the big element of this movie is Ella has such a compulsion to continue creating the short film that, you know, she disregards the self-destructive nature that a lot of this has, you know?
Yeah.
And the havoc that it causes on her own life and the lives of the people around her.
Yeah.
You gotta respect it. You gotta respect that beast.
Well, yeah, so we glossed over it a little bit, but, you know, we see her working with her mother at the beginning. Her mother's very demanding and, kind of oppressive. And her mother has a stroke and she's in the hospital. And Ella feels compelled to finish the film for her. Her boyfriend, who's like a real estate developer or something, sets her up in this empty apartment in a largely condemned building that is going to be torn down at some point. There's only a few people still living there that she can use as her studio to finish the film. You mentioned she meets this little girl who's supposedly one of her neighbors who comes in and basically tells her that the film she's working on is trash, start over, I'm going to tell the story and you're going to make the film. It's about a little girl who's lost in the woods. She hides in a house and there's somebody out there who's coming for her. There's this, the man nobody wants to meet, the Ash Man.
I like how the little girl's story is structured because it's over the course of 3 nights.
Yes. Threes, baby.
Yeah.
The Ash Man comes on 3 nights, and what does he do on each night? Well, we learn about that throughout the film, and as the film sort of takes on a life of its own, Ella starts sort of manifesting things about the film into her real life.
Well, and the demands of the girl get more and more dark and twisted.
Yeah. She first, you know, tells her, is like, oh, you should use that. She sees that she's playing with some mortician's wax. She's like, use that to create a new little girl for the story that looks better. And so she does, and it's like, oh, well, there's still something not right. You should use raw meat so she'll feel really real.
Yeah, and this is one of Robert Morgan's strengths. Like, he has such an eye for texture.
Yes.
Like, even in the...
The texturally grotesque.
Yes, even in, like, the real-life footage. Like, again, since he came from a stop-motion animation background, every shot is so meticulously composed and thought out.
You have to.
That, like, you think about, like, even the mundane textures. Like, I think of, like, the textures of the big steaks that they're cooking for her mom and her...
Mm-hmm.
And, like, how it just kind of has, like, just a gross look to it. It's, like, grayish almost.
That classic British food. grays and browns and mushy peas, right? Yeah, and, you know, just seeing how that evolves in the creation of Ella's film and how the little girl puppet gets, like, grosser looking because it's like wet and red, and you know when she's making the Ash Man, they call him the Ash Man because she takes like cigarette ashes from the trash and like sprinkles them over the meat that she's used to construct him, which just like adds to that texture. And then later the little girl is like, it's not enough, you need something dead to create the Ash Man. She leads her to like this dead fox out in the woods, is like, this is what you're gonna use.
Yeah.
And like the effect is great, and you know, I think to Robert Morgan's credit, because of what an exceptional stop motion artist he is, that's another thing this film has going for it, is like, I don't think there's like really any CG in the film at all, except for maybe like some digital compositing, maybe some atmospheric effects. I guess like the shots of the evil egg floating in the void, you know, there's some,
that was partially stop motion.
I mean, the egg is, but the background looks kind of digital, or rather digitally enhanced. My point is, the effects in this movie are fucking fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it goes without saying that the stop motion is just some of the best I've seen in a feature film. But, like, on top of that, you not only have that, you have, like, gore and, like, weird...
I mean, it's a horror movie, so there, you know, there's definitely some violence, especially as Ella starts to go crazier and her anxieties reach a peak.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the Ash Man, and, like, the Ash Man is such a literal stand-in for death made out of a corpse. It has ashes.
It's covered in ashes.
Yeah. First off, I just think before we get too deep into the details or weeds, I mean, we already kind of covered the end as well.
Yeah.
I just tell you, like, go watch the fucking movie.
Yeah,
like,
it'll be on Shudder in May. It had a limited theatrical run, so I don't know if it'll still be available.
So you just leave the podcast up in a tab until May and, you know, come back to it. There you go.
Exactly.
we're pretty far in for spoilers now. But I mean...
But I thought it would be funny to mention. But I think the themes of this film are all quite direct and things that have been told before. However, what makes it work is technical elements and the quality of it. And this goes to something, this speaks to something I've said before, and that is, I am often less concerned interested, but less concerned with whether something is original, just that it's well made, right? To me, that is more important. When I'm putting on a pair of shoes, the first thing I'm considering is are they well made? I don't really give a shit if my shoes are original, right?
Says the guy who bought a pair of 99-cent flip-flops a few years ago. And they broke 2 weeks later. And I told you, spend $15 on the slightly better made pair of flip flops, and they'll last you years. And that's what I did. And they, guess what? They lasted me for years.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And you should. You should care about quality. And often it will benefit you. But yeah, and I think this film is a great example of that. We've all seen these themes a million times. I'll just go ahead and say it. The young girl is obviously, like, her younger self is a muse, mm-hmm. but here's what's cool. Thank God the film never says it. It alludes
to it, but it doesn't...
It alludes to it pretty heavily.
It screams it at you, it just doesn't use words.
Yes.
It just doesn't literally exposit it.
Yeah,
but it does. But it does scream it at you.
Of course, it's the themes are abundant and apparent and all-encompassing. All this movie is these core themes. It's just that they're executed quite well, in my opinion. I do certainly agree. I think that they come right up to the line for me when it comes to being tolerably heavy-handed. It like just toes are just really pushing. They're right about to go over the edge.
I'm glad you brought it up because I will take this opportunity to nitpick the film a little bit. Because I to be clear, and I think my rating will reflect this later, I do like this movie a lot, and I think that, like you said, it's extremely well executed, and ultimately execution is what matters. And I don't particularly care about originality because every story has been told. But I will say, like, I'm a story guy. Like, I'm a plot guy. And I went into this movie with very high expectations. And I walked out of it feeling just a little bit hollow because I don't feel like it ever surprised me. I thought that, like, structurally, it was, like, extremely predictable, and I think that the way that it, like, handles these things in a vacuum is all very good. But I think, especially from, like, a debut feature from somebody who is known for being a little bit more abstract and kind of surreal, I was kind of hoping for something a little bit less predictable, a little bit more transgressive, and I felt like it just kind of treads so many of the common boards of a film about how an artist lets their art consume them and everything around them.
Yeah, well,
blah,
I mean, director known for stop motion animation making a movie about a stop motion animator struggling with the creative process is...
Like, it's very self-reflexive.
Yeah, extremely self-reflexive. And I would even argue it's earnest to a fault at mm-hmm. times. You know,
yeah, well,
like,
said.
I think he's really earnest in what he's trying to say with it. But because of that, it's predictable and on the nose.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, I agree. Like, the story in this film is a bit sloppy. He throws a lot of ideas in the first half of the movie at you. And then he doesn't fully develop them. Like, the mother-daughter relationship is kind of abandoned.
Yeah, I mean, they come back to it at the end, and I think they get a little bit too heavy-handed with it there.
Literally heavy-handed.
Like, yeah,
You know, she's, like, doing a stop motion with her hand.
Well, and also, literally, because, like, in that final, quote-unquote, confrontation with her mother that she has in her head, like, the mother is literally... She literally says that, like, you can never do anything yourself. You always have to have somebody pulling your strings. If it's not me, it's somebody else. And it's like... That was a moment where I'm like, well, you don't need to say it. We've been watching it for the entire movie. Like, you don't need to say it.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I don't think that concept was abandoned. If anything, yeah, like they came in pretty hard with it at the end.
What I will say is, like, I
guess underbaked is a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
Under elaborated.
Because, you know, like that and you
It's like, what's your point?
Yeah. You know? You have the sister of Ella's boyfriend who works at an advertising firm also making weird, gross Robert Morgan stop motion animation.
Right, like what kind of fucking... That's so funny because in the movie Ella's like, I would rather die than work at a place like this. And we see it depicted as like this place of soulless creativity, but also like... In fucking 2024, what ad agencies are putting money and time into, like, stop-motion ads? Like, advertising is so much lazier. Well, that feels like something very personal for Robert Morgan.
Yeah, and the little clips they were showing of the, like, the reel that she was showing.
One of them is just straight up a Robert Morgan short. Yeah.
It was from Bobby, yeah.
No, it was from, I'm blanking on the name of the other. It's an earlier one than Bobby. Yeah.
But they're really grotesque and not great to look at, which is weird for, you know, commercial
like a commercial, yeah. Art.
And there's a whole subplot about Ella's idea being stolen from her.
Right.
And like that feels underbaked too.
Well, again, it all feels very personal.
Yes.
You know, it all feels very personal. And yeah, exactly. And like, I think another thing too is that like, I think that this film is like, for non-creative types, probably very difficult to relate to. I mean, I think like anybody who works can relate to sort of like that idea of like letting your work consume you, like sure. creative or otherwise. But I do think that like, yeah, it's so self-reflexive, like it's so personal that like if you don't have that kind of relationship to art or things that you create, that it can be hard to like put yourself into that, you know? And I mean, that's okay. Like, not everything is for everybody. It's really sure, not, like, sure. that's truly
well,
not
I will
a big
say,
deal.
Like,
but
the people who feel that way, I feel like even so, they're going to get something out of the execution of this film.
They might learn how that experience is taken.
A, it's some of the best stop motion animation I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And B, like, this movie is one of the rare movies to get me, like, viscerally squirming at times later in the movie, with a few scenes we'll get into later. So, like, it's effective.
Extremely.
You know?
Yeah.
The story might not resonate, you know, perfectly, but it gets you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that... you know, it might not even seem as predictable to people who don't watch as many movies as we do, you know? Like, sure. there's an outlier fact. Like, that's a kind of unrelatable thing for a lot of people as well. You know, I always am surprised when I talk to, like, one of my coworkers or something. They're like, yeah, I watch, like, 2 movies a month. I'm like, what? It's like people be like, I haven't been to the theater in 5 years. Like, what? How do you live like that? So ultimately, yeah, that's kind of a moot point, I guess. While I'm kind of harping on it, the little girl, like, I think she's very good, and yes. I like the dynamic with her and Ella, but like, she's the best example of like the predictability of the film, because from basically the first shot she appeared in the movie, I'm like, oh, she's not real.
I mean, from the trailer.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest, like,
the trailer doesn't quite give you enough, I don't think. Like,
I watched it and I was like, oh yeah, I think she's a,
like, I think it suggests it, but it's like really when you see the movie, it's like, oh yeah, this little girl ain't real. And it's like it almost tries to treat that as like a twist at the end,
yeah,
in a way that I'm like dog, we know.
I feel like one of the few unexpected
who are you trying
parts,
to fool
one of the few unexpected parts of this movie is how twisted like her suggestions become.
Yeah, like, well, I mean, that's always fun. Is children with a true sense of the macabre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Playing with a dead fox corpse and.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's always particularly uncanny with children, because it's like, they haven't really developed, like, a sense of empathy yet. So it's hard to tell if it's, like, that's just a kid, or is, like, oh, are they actually a psychopath?
Yeah, you know? Well, and it's extra twisted because she's dancing around the studio repeating armature.
That was heavy-handed to me. She might as well just be going, puppet themes, like, around, but, like, but again, like, I make that joke with love. I don't think I would ask that to be different. Like, I do like armature and, like, her playing on that and her singing that and also, like, just making its way into the score. I love that shit. I love those types of themes. And, you know, it's funny, you were mentioning this film being alienating to, you know, like, to like, you know, people who...
Potentially,
you theorized. For me, like, I mean, obviously, like I feel like this movie was, like, almost so specifically made, like, for me.
That yeah, right. It is...
Like you said, I think you said it perfectly, Ben. Like it is authentic to a fault. I feel like this film was so perfectly made for me that I didn't gain anything from it because it's already like just that's just like yeah, damn, that's my experience. Like for me, I want to talk about the stop motion production for a second. Like in the film, the advertising agency. Yes, you are right. Who is asking for stop motion advertising right now? Right?
Well, like grotesque
stop motion.
Well, yeah, who's doing it? Like, I would love to see ads as weird as the kind of stuff that they were showing that the film was treating as so sterile, you know?
But I think part of that is it's grafted on to be that for the sake of kind of carrying those themes throughout the film.
Sure.
And I'm happy to allow that because the themes that are expressed with the advertising agency are really good, and I love that it is an advertising agency because the money that goes into advertisement is equal to large-scale film budgets. And often that is for condensed time, right?
Yeah, sure.
Like, you get these films, like they get, like, Ridley Scott to do ads and shit, right? Or, like, D.O.R.
Well, people this, like Ridley really Scott started in ads before, David... I mean, yeah, every now and then he'll direct something, and directors will still do some ads and stuff, but the Scott brothers and people like David Fincher, like, they started in ads before they moved to films.
And, to make a living doing their art.
Hmm?
And the boyfriend is, you know, exists as another, like, allegory for that same thing. Like, he's a musician.
But well, he says he's a musician. He's,
yeah, right.
That's, but he's not. She even tells him, she's like, he keeps talking about, like, oh, yeah, you know, like, you look at stop motion the way I think about music, and, like, oh, yeah, you can come on tour with me and make my music videos and stuff for me. And she's like, at a certain point, she's like, dude, you don't make music. You go to an office and work in real estate.
Yeah. Well, on the flip side, you know, even after Ella says, you know, she'd kill herself before she works in ads, she ends up going to, you know, do some work for the commercial agency.
Right.
And it's talked up to her, like, she's going to be making her own shorts for the agency. And she gets there, and she's assigned to just make a bunch of eyeballs.
Yep. Yeah. And 100 just eyes. But the pupil here, 3 centimeters, 4 centimeters.
Of, like, artistic work. When you get there and it's just doing a repetitive, grinding, crushing trade.
Right, it's not actually...
very simple and mindless.
Yeah, or you're not actually doing anything creative. You're just, like, an assembly line, essentially.
And plenty of, like, the, you know, the covers and things that I've made are, you know, made by committee.
Sure,
know, for my day
I mean...
job, too. It's like, you know, like, it's still... I still have the luxury of, like, sitting down and getting to paint at the end of a day, but it is often for, like, a product, you know?
Yeah,
it is,
I mean,
it
you're
is
not...
for something that...
It's just... You know, it's
I'm
just...
very fortunate to have, like, side things and other things where I can still express the art, but, like, in my day job, like, yeah, I'm a painter for my day job, but I'm still a painter for products. I'm still a painter for capitalism, you know? And, like, I have to make these things for people, and I have to make what they want. Not just what they want, but I have to make what people want to buy. You know, and what makes people want to buy things.
Yeah, well, I mean, the vast majority of people, if you work in America or the Western world, like, you're not getting paid to be creative most of the time. The lucky few are. Anyway.
Much of the time.
Yeah, well, I also think the thing with, like, the ad agency in this movie is that, like, it almost becomes a victim of its own conceit, because, like, it needs to be there so she can, like, turn to that in a moment of desperation, like, going to work somewhere she said she'd rather die working, and then using that to discover that they've been, that the sister has been stealing her ideas to use for their own thing.
I love
And I think
this.
That that's kind of why it's like, well, that's why the ad firm has to be specifically stop motion, because why would she be hired there otherwise? Because that's all she knows
but
how to do.
The thing is, those sorts of studios do that all the time, right?
Yeah.
You know, a great example of that, I would think, is a while back when, like, Amy Schumer got called out for, like, stealing all those jokes. And it was later shown that, like, one of her writers also was just trying to make deadlines and didn't have a choice. Well, you know, big quotes around didn't have a choice.
You always have a choice.
This, yeah, well, you know, within the confines of a broken system, yes. But, like, to make those deadlines, to make those means, art gets ground into product, you know? It gets, and, like, she saw something of valuable inspiration there. And what I really like about that is that our protagonist, she sees... Because she's been working on her whole stop-motion story about this girl lost in the woods, and there's all this stuff going on. The sister sees it at the bar. And then she gets there to work at the job, and she sees that they're doing their own ad about a girl lost in the woods. And she looks over, and she sees a mood board that's just images from her short.
Yeah.
And the sister earnestly doesn't see anything wrong with it, right? She sees it as a compliment, as flattery, you know. Because
she's like, we took your good idea and we spruced it up, you know. Yeah. That's not the
we gave it a budget,
term, yeah.
You know. We put like more into it, and
they sterilized it, you know. They made it more less grotesque,
exactly.
Less unique, more
that's the truth behind the
code. Yeah, more consumable.
And so, like, yeah, like they cope with that because they have to make their living, to make their due, you know, in their eyes. And so that's one of my favorite moments in the movie. It's like when she sees that they're just using her art as a mood board, and there is some truth to that. And What I like about that too is that it's just another way in which she has been made a puppet, but now she's been made a puppet by the industry,
right?
And I say those words, I hear them coming out of my mouth, and I do feel like a pretentious art guy, you know. Like, I think it's pretty basic.
Well, it's on the nose. It's all very on the nose.
Like,
but also
fine,
like,
okay.
That's,
you know, like
to sort of like contradict what I was saying earlier. Like, it's on the nose, but that kind of stuff, like, is relatable.
Again,
like, at least
earnest.
Those
it feels like Robert Morgan is legitimately speaking from his own life experiences.
Yeah. And it's like, even if you can't relate to the idea of creativity or being creative or like a stifled creative process, like, pretty much everybody can relate to being
plagiarized.
Well, being a cog in the machine of capitalism, like, everybody can relate to that. Everyone can relate to being just like one stop on an assembly line of manufacturing product to be consumed. So at least in that sense, very relatable. So yeah, I guess, you know, you can get your relation where you need to in this movie. We should probably talk some about the Ashman, and
yeah,
the
Ashman cometh.
The Ashman cometh, and the spooky stuff, because I mean, this is a horror film after all. I think a lot of these sequences are very, very well done.
Best part of the movie,
yeah, particularly the second one. So, you know, as we kind of alluded to already, you know, the little girl is telling her this story. The Ashman comes on three nights. And you're going to hate this, Cleveland, but I was thinking it in the movie and I'm going to say it now. This part reminded me very much of The Empty Man, your favorite movie.
Yeah.
Because similarly to The Ashman...
Don't credit that to The Empty Man.
Similarly to The Ashman...
Don't fucking give that to the fucking
The Empty Man.
Man
also comes on three nights.
Yeah, and so does, like, every bit of, like, mythology from fucking... For the past 200 years.
But
that's
okay.
Not theirs.
But
they don't own that. Fuck you. That goes back to, like,
like,
we're gonna do Celtic stories. But Cleveland, we're gonna do a side by side of what the Ashman and the Empty Man do on each of the three nights.
Fine, I'll just grab my drink like a baby bottle and just sit.
Yeah, you're gonna sit through this.
I am.
And also, the Empty Man. Good movie.
It's a good movie.
The Empty Man's a good movie. The Empty Man's a good movie.
Good start, good end. Shit. But, fine, it's fine.
Tulpa.
Fuck you. Tulpa, you're fucking...
So, the Ashman. What happens on the first night when the Ashman comes? He sees her. What happens on the first night that the Empty Man comes? He sees you. Boom. 1-1. Second night that the Ashman comes, he touches her. What happens on the second night that the Empty Man comes? He finds you, which is pretty stupid. I don't know how that's different from him seeing you, but anyway.
he finds your soul.
And on the third night when the Ashman comes, what happens? Well, they never really say it, but he eats your face.
He consumes you.
You become the Ashman.
And
your death.
And what happens on the third night when the Empty Man comes?
He takes your face.
He takes you.
Your face.
So the Ashman, the Empty Man, basically the same thing.
Damn. 1-2, Freddy's coming for you.
And also
3-4, better lock your door. 5-6. Suck a dick. What is it?
Also, Cleveland, I'm sorry to extend the metaphor, but the Ashman, also a tulpa.
Yeah, sure. You know what? Awesome. You forget that I love tulpas, that I love that concept, and I think it's extremely
cool.
But
I'm just saying that the Ashman is the Empty Man.
You know what's really fucking cool with this movie? It doesn't look at the fucking camera and go, he's a tulpa, wop wop.
That's true. They never find a piece of paper in this movie that says tulpa on it.
Yeah, so I respect this movie more than the Empty Man, because the Empty Man can't fucking help itself. All right. Yeah,
and this movie
feels to dumb down for the viewer.
This movie is probably also like a more accurate depiction of a tulpa, because
yes.
It's also not like
anything.
It's not literal, you know, like, I mean, this is another one of those movies. Again, it's been done so many times where none of it is fucking literal. Like, it's all in her head, and she's losing her mind through all of it, and her insanity drives her to acts of violence, you know, and ultimately to her doom.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, through a not quite literal like creation of this monster figure that
pretty allegoric.
Yeah, that is mirroring what is happening in the film. Each night in her stop-motion film, when the Ashman comes, something, then after that, after she's animated it, then the Ashman comes for real.
Yeah, I love the progression of how it bleeds into reality. Like, especially on the second day, where the first day, you know, we get kind of the full animation of the day of, you know, her
being. Yeah, they always show that first,
and
yeah.
The second day, the Ashman kind of rises from the actual set.
Yeah, that is very cool. Because, like, the first night, you know, she hears some sounds out in the stairwell, and she goes, and she sort of, like, looks down the stairwell, and I do really like this, though, where she, like, kind of sees something, like, shambling its way up the stairs, and it looks, you know, raw and burned, and she runs back into the apartment and, you know, hears something shuffle up and bangs on the door, just like the Ashman does in her film, and she looks through the peephole, and there's a nasty, you know, bloodshot eye looking back at her. Eyes are a big deal in this movie, you know.
Yeah.
The second night, yeah, she's, like, working, and she, like, moves some, like, dirt on the table, and I think she sees the eye again first, right? Like, the eye opens, and then, like, the Ashman kind of, like, rises up from under her set, basically, the piles of dirt with all the sticks stuck into it to make trees and stuff. That part was very cool. I really liked that effect.
Well, and it turns into a bit of a chase scene. And I love how it seamlessly goes from live action to her just being the animated character.
Yeah.
And, like,
but like even less formed, yes. like a more raw, sort of featureless, like little figure that's made out of that, like mortician's wax. She's
still finding herself.
Yeah.
So she doesn't have a face. I really like the alternate when, cause it goes back and forth so many times, where we see the Ash Man in real life. Like there are a few shots where like it's a guy in a suit.
Yeah.
And it's,
yeah. Well, this is one of them when he comes up out of the table.
Yeah, exactly. Out of the table. Like it's a, they built it to scale and it still seems to move like stop motion. That's where like I wonder like, okay, do they composite, you know, or like, or do they just have move that way? Do they digitally like change it? It's hard to say. But what I like is that they don't harp on it for too long. I think a lesser film probably would have like had much more sequences of him being like full scale to size and it looked kind of stop motion-y, but not being like, this film really plays to the strengths of stop motion wherever it can. Like, it doesn't fuck with it for very long. It tries it here and there to success and it worked quite well, but yeah. it doesn't wallow in it.
I love in that chase scene, the stop motion version of her runs away and she finds this hole. And she goes in it, and it's this...
She becomes small. Yeah. It's like a mouse hole in like the baseboard.
Yeah, it's this bright gold room where everything is kind of grotesque and dirty and grimy. Like, it's this bright, metallic almost room.
Yeah, like gold fabric.
Yeah, and she tries to go through the hole, and she gets stuck.
Mm.
She can't make her way through.
I'm stuck, bro.
And,
Oh, God.
Oh, no. I love how that imagery plays in later in the film.
Mm-hmm. Comes back around at the very end. In a
tangible way.
Well, yeah, all that second night when the Ashman, like, catches her, he, this is, again, something we kind of alluded to earlier. He, like, barfs up like a gross black egg and like puts that in her mouth and like makes her eat it. And, you know, there are a couple of times in the movie where we see it's the so scene of just like nasty. Yeah,
that's this, the most Bobby yeah
this egg yeah like mm-hmm. rotating in this kind of metallic void, this gestating evil egg. I think it's the very first shot of the film, too, yeah, actually.
Yeah, they open
is,
with that.
Yeah, is that...
The
is
inspiration
that
egg. It's the Angel's Egg, man. It's creation. It's all things. It falls back to that, which... Yeah, shout out to Angel's Egg. If you haven't watched it, I would highly recommend it.
After that, things degrade even further. I think it might be before the second night, but she goes to a party.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I really love that... party sequence.
Strobe light.
Because she's trying to find her inspiration, and the boyfriend's sister mentioned that, like, she can't make anything if she's not on drugs.
If she's not tripping her tits off.
Yeah.
So she has her best ideas when she's tripping her tits off.
Easy to say when you work in the corporate art world. Like, yeah, alright, sure. And still clock in. Like, yeah, alright.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm not bitter.
I love the subversion of that because, you know, when she goes to that party, like you said, she's trying to find inspiration. So she asks the sister if she has anything that she can take. She gives her a tab of acid. And, you know, this whole party scene reminded me very much of, I mean, count the inspirations, yeah. Harmony Korine.
Very
recently,
psychedelic.
Recently, it reminded me of, like, Brandon Cronenberg's stuff, like the orgy scene in Infinity Pool, which I just rewatched not that long ago.
I would also go as far back as The Wall.
Oh, I think, yeah, I mean...
The Wall also has a lot of very similar themes here as well.
Yeah, there's like a creepy ventriloquist art, a video art piece being projected. There's
which is cool because it's not stop motion.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I thought was cool. Like, it kind of has the same veneer as like Robert Morgan's stuff, but it is like it's like a puppet.
Like a Brothers Quay.
Mm-hmm.
And they
well, I mean, Robert Morgan is pretty heavily inspired by Brothers Quay. I mean, same.
They're fucking awesome.
And it's very uncanny. You know, it feels familiar to Robert Morgan stuff, but it's not the same. And you also have this weird woman who has her eyelids painted, so they look like eyeballs.
Mm-hmm.
The classic Indiana Jones move.
Again, the eyeball imagery in this movie, the being the watching and the being watched, the voyeur, that timeless theme. I love the culmination of that party scene because, like, she watches, like, these two dudes, like, get in a fight and, like, one breaks a beer bottle over the other dude's head and, like, gashes him in the forehead quite badly. And she's just, like, standing there and he's, like, kneeling on the floor dazed. And she, like, starts putting her finger, like, into the gash up under, like, the flap of skin and stuff.
You gotta know what it's about. What's under there? What's going on?
Which is kind of mirrored again later when she cuts into her own leg and uses her own flesh.
I love how they play with kind of the motif of, like, mending and shaping flesh.
Yeah.
There's a sex scene earlier in that party sequence, and it's just repeated imagery of her, like, kneading the boyfriend's back and, like, pinching parts and stuff like that. And it feels like she's kind of working out a model, almost.
Yeah, tactile. Yeah. Trying to make the flesh move.
What I love is that after that, though, after that whole scene, like, she goes back home, and I think the boyfriend comes by the next day or something, is like, what the fuck, like, were you on something last night? And she, like, reaches into her boot and she pulls out the tab of acid and she's like, no, I never took it.
Which I love!
I liked that too, because, like, that whole party scene is, like, treated like a psychedelic trip. Like, she's under the influence. So for later, it to be like, no, I actually didn't take
it's
anything.
It's a statement I fucking stand by. Like,
it's like, she's actually crazy.
Yeah. Well, no. But also, hold on.
But
Hear me out. Hear me out. because too, like, I have heard this. Growing up, I've heard this constantly that, like, oh yeah, like, People will look at, like, weird art that I make or whatever, and they'll be like, oh, what drugs were you on? Like, what were you thinking? Or, like, oh, man, when you look at the wall, like, oh, like, all these drugs. You know, when did this... Look at all these psychedelic art, you know, like... And the reality is that, yeah, you can take acid and you can find...
But Sid Mead was on acid.
Ideas, right? But not the whole time. No one's on acid the whole time. No one's, like, fucking, like, out of their gourd. Like, because you need motor skills. You need to be able to, like, create the thing. And you're not gonna be able to when you're fucking impaired. And, like, life itself is a drug, man. Like, I don't know. I know that's, like, the lamest shit ever. But, like, I stand by it. Like, you don't need, like, fucking...
Life is not a drug. Life is a highway, okay?
Yeah, and you're not gonna ride it all that long. Yeah. Shut up. Like, for real, though. Like, for real. Like, you drugs are... They can help. Like, you know, like, a chemical assist can help.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think when people say, like, oh, what drugs were they on, I don't think they mean it, like, what drugs were they on literally.
I think
when
they do. I think a lot of people do. Like, when they really... Because, like, most people don't understand how art is made. Like, most people don't understand the time and effort and actual, like, practice that goes into making something like that, which is what stop motion is all about, right? Like, the rigor and how much trouble it is to very slowly, millimeter by millimeter, make this thing, right? It's a lot of work.
Yeah, but I mean, I know where you're going, but, like, when they say that, like, oh, were you on drugs? Like, I don't think they literally mean it, like, that you were on drugs in the process of making it. Is that that the drugs were the impetus, were the inspiration, were the seed of the idea. And I think that is, like, yeah, a lot of people don't know how art is made, and that is a cheap way of dismissing, like, the surreal.
Right.
Yes. But... You also have the other side of it where, like, plenty of people have been inspired to create great art while under the influence of various substances.
To me, it's this.
Like,
right?
It's...
And I think this metaphor will do. It's corny as fuck, but it is simply this. You can use drugs as a sword to kill the dragon. Again, corny. I told you it was corny. I told you it was corny going in. You can use drugs as a sword to kill the dragon, but the hero is the one killing the dragon, right? Like, you're the one executing on the thing. Drugs are a chemical assist, but they're not the hero of the fucking thing.
Is it a samurai?
But if you take away the
sword
from the hero, how does he kill the dragon?
A battle axe, another way.
Oh, where did he get the battle axe? What is the battle axe?
His past trauma. It's his inspiration.
Oh, okay, all right.
It's a different muse. It's the muse. It's not the mechanism. You know, like
it's a different. Tool in the kit.
Yeah, there's plenty of ways to kill a dragon. Whatever. Shut up. It's not a perfect metaphor. I'm working on. You're hearing me workshop it in real time. I'm a little drunk.
Life is.
I thought you were an artist.
I sure am.
I love how she pulls out the drugs because you know.
Yeah.
It really recontextualizes that whole party scene because I feel like the big thing is it's shot so psychedelic styled that it would be easy to be like, oh. Dude, acid, whoa.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. That is the pretense of the film. Like, you think, when you're watching it, you think that she is under the influence of acid because you've seen her be given a tab of acid.
Yeah.
And yes, we never see her take it, but...
I love how it just descends further after that. Like, the little girl comes back and she doesn't... just want to use the fox carcass. She wants, you know, actual flesh.
Yeah, something fresher. Which is at the same time that the boyfriend and the sister come over to try to, like, they're trying to get her to stop making the film. It's bad for you. It's fucking with your head, like, you're not processing your trauma. So we're gonna make you stop. And then, of course, she fucking, she kills them. Who could have seen that coming?
Murder!
Right?
That doesn't happen right away, because she gets stitched up, and there's that great scene, where she's in bed, and there's the little stop-motion character that comes into her room.
Oh, yeah, the little stop-motion her. Well, that's how she gets the wound in her leg that she has to get the stitches for, that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And again, like that's a. I'm sure that there like 100% is some digital compositing there, but like that little figure like climbing up on the bed and like going
it
up to her
great.
Leg and like digging into the flesh of her leg again, like molding that
it's very
flesh.
Unsettling.
Yeah, I know it's extremely well done. Yeah. And that's why she has to get the stitches for the wound in her leg that nobody knows where it came from.
But yeah, then the boyfriend and her sister come and intervene. As she's reopening
right.
Grabbing part of the flesh.
Yeah, because before they show up, like, the little girl is, like, telling her to, like, dig into her own wound. And it's like, that's a very gruesome scene that when she's cutting into herself, she, like, pulls out, like, one of the tendons in her leg or something. And it's, like, right as the boyfriend and and his sister show up.
That made me legitimately squirm in my seat.
Yeah.
It's very visceral.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you feel it because, like, again, Robert Morgan, coming from a stop-motion background, he has such an eye for detail and texture. So you see, like, the stitches being cut.
To dig into that even more, like, you can really feel, like, the tension, like, as she's, like, ripping out, like, the tendon. Like, if you've ever, like split, like raw chicken, like, wings or legs and stuff. I used to have to do that a lot as a cook, like, to prepare wings. And, like, you chop it at the joint, and then you kind of have to, like, pull the tendons apart a little bit. And, like, you really get that same kind of, like, impression in this. And it's, it's very...
It's nasty.
It's very, very nasty. And, like, that is... I think as we're getting into the end here, like, it's all of the final Ashman stuff, like, I think is in her head as she's bleeding out, as she dies from this horrible wound that she's, like, torn into her leg after killing her boyfriend and his sister and using their flesh to construct larger homunculi of the little girl and the Ash Man.
You know,
they're like more like toddler size.
Yeah, toddler size. Yeah, like all that flesh, it kind of gets condensed down.
Yeah,
the model. But I like that because at the end of the day, I touched on this at the beginning of the episode. They're equal parts allegory to the girl. You know, they're an allegory of selling out. They're an allegory of just becoming a cog in the industry for the sake of art.
Freaking, you know, normies.
They're like, and she
cannibalizes them for real art.
For real art.
She uses their raw materials.
Like, yeah,
for true creation.
Yeah, exactly. And there you go. That's it.
I love after she kills the two of them and brings them back into the apartment. She tries to kill the kid by like Bart Simpsoning her.
Yeah,
like just choking her out.
I think that actually happens before the brother and the boyfriend and the sister show up. Yeah, because she's
been
like
a few days since we've seen.
She thinks that like if she kills the girl, then she won't be able to finish the story, and the Ashman won't be able to get her or whatever. Mm. And yeah, so she strangles her to death, and then that's the part that treats it as like a reveal that the girl isn't real, because she like chokes her to death on the couch, and then she like looks up, and the girl is like standing there. She's like, "You get that out of your system."
I think it's kind of cute.
It's very cheeky.
Yeah, like it is done, but like it treats it like
it's a reveal, but it's like we've known all.
It's not like the music like heavily swells or all the rest.
And the music doesn't have to heavily swell. It's cut like a fucking twist reveal.
I know, but like I will say I also remember like the majority of the audience like chuckling at that too. You know, like
I mean, it's fine. Her cheeky little "did you get that out of your system" line. Like it's I mean, it's fine. It's fine. It's just like it made me roll my eyes a little bit because it's like, this isn't as clever as they're playing it out. It's like, we've known that the little girl is not real this whole time. We've known she's a figment of the imagination.
But this final sequence with the Ashman,
mm-hmm, where he literally takes on a life of his own, because Ella's asking, is like, what does he do on the third night? What does he do? And she's like, just watch. And they're watching these two like larger puppets start to move and play out what happens, but then the Ashman turns and starts walking towards them, and the little girl seems afraid for the first time. She's like, wait, what's happening? He's not supposed to do that. This is not what's supposed to happen. So Ella runs into the closet and locks herself in there, and then the Ashman appears in the closet and smooths out her face until she doesn't have a face.
Yeah,
corpse wax
sequence that's kind of hard to describe because it's much scarier in the film than it is to just kind of say it. Like, he like caves in her face.
Well, yeah,
he's as if it's moldable.
They're like standing in this sort of like, they start in the closet, but it becomes just sort of like this empty void that they're both in, and he's like remolding her face until she like no longer has a face, and then he starts like eating her face. And then it sort of, and this is all like while the we see the evil egg spinning in its black void starts to hatch, and it just kind of like sprays out some blood. And then we see at the end like her in a large, like fully realized version of the house from her film, where the Ashman comes, and she goes to a chest that is in the room.
Yeah, well, one of the last words her mother says to her is, you know, you'll always be a puppet, and you know what happens to puppets when people are done with them? They go back into the box.
Oh, yes, yes. They go back, they go back into the chest, and so that we see she opens up this chest that's in the room, and I can see Cleveland over there cheesing, waiting to make a joke that he's made on at least three or four other episodes of this podcast that you have used your name before. Go ahead and get out of your system.
I mean, finish the story.
She opens up the chest, and it's the same like gold material that we saw earlier on the second night when like her little stop motion figure ran into that room and got stuck. It's the inside of the chest, and she climbs into the chest, and she closes the lid as the credits
roll. I'm the man in the box!
There it is.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, I love, like, the symbolic part of that, not only because it's like poetry rhymes, but like, on the second day, you know, it's as if her character is trying to be done with the story. She's trying to go back into the box.
And, yeah.
You know, end the story, and she can't.
The story's not over yet. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she can't, no matter how much she wants to be done and be out. That's why she goes to work for the ad agency in the first place, is because she is afraid of what happens on the third night, so she tries to put a stop to it. But no, the egg has already been laid, so it must be hatched. The story must be told. It must be finished. But at the cost of consuming her entirely. And so as she dies and has served her purpose, the puppet is put back into the toy chest, back into the box, and the credits roll.
The egg hatches. The art lives on.
The art lives on.
Again, it's very on the nose and earnest to a fault, but you know what? It's executed very well.
And you know, it feels like Robert Morgan was trying to work some stuff out about his own life and his own career.
And you know, it's
a classic artist thing to do. How many of our greatest artists and how many of our greatest filmmakers have brought us masterpieces just through trying to work some shit out about themselves? I don't know. I don't think this movie's a masterpiece. Not for me, but it's damn good.
Yeah.
Do we want to rate? Is there anything else y'all want to touch on?
I just wanted to mention the soundtrack is fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the weird off-kilter piano and electronic score.
I noticed in the credits a lot of the tracks were attributed to an artist called I think the Oscillator, but who at the very end of the credits there was also like an RIP tribute to.
Oh. Hmm.
I don't know anything about this artist, and I didn't take the time to look it up before we recorded, but
maybe his final work.
Yeah, maybe his final work, or maybe Robert Morgan just licensed the music, you know, for the movie or something. But yeah, very fitting. I mean, we didn't really touch on it much either, but just like in general, the sound is very good.
Yeah, again,
very high attention to detail with the Foley, because again, like Robert Morgan stuff, like mm-hmm. stop motion, like you got like for that immersive, you know, that immersion, you gotta have good sound.
When so many of his shorts don't have voice,
don't have dialogue, just a lot of weird little guys going in general distress. Sound design, sound work, all really fantastic.
Why don't you slap a rating on it?
I got some narrative problems with it, but the execution is really great. Overall, a film that I would definitely recommend. Strong 4 out of 5 for me.
This movie is the best movie of 2024 so far.
We're going to see Dune this weekend. Yeah.
Well, that might be outdated soon, but at the time of recording of the movies I've seen, it's the best of the three.
I would agree.
it has some narrative issues, and again, it's earnest to a fault and on the nose. But it's executed so well. It's some of the best stop-motion animation I've ever seen. And Robert Morgan, I think he did a great job, especially for a debut feature.
To go.
I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. You know, it has problems, but I respect the hell out of it.
I'm going to ditto that. I think it came out right when I needed it to. I've been thinking about these sorts of themes a lot lately, and it's what I really needed to see, I think. To sort of help align me on my path. So I'm very grateful to this film, and I appreciate it. And I felt like I was very, very personally and directly spoken to. I have many thanks to this film. A big 4.5 out of 5.
Cleve finding noble purpose in the film. And me, I just say, yeah, that was pretty good. Anyway, that'll give Stop Motion a strong average of 4.3 out of 5. If you do happen to have an opportunity to see it somewhere on the big screen during its very limited theatrical release right now, check it out if you can. Otherwise, catch it on Shudder in a couple of months. Well worth your time. And I mean, geez, watch some other Robert Morgan stuff if you're not familiar. Like, most of it's on YouTube.
Yeah, it's all great.
Like, yeah, check out Baba Yaa and stuff like that. Yeah.
I'm sure we'll cover it soon enough for the podcast. I think next short series I do.
Yeah, you've been hinting at that for a while. Anyway, next week we're moving on to a Patreon pick episode.
Yes.
I've consulted the spreadsheet, consulted the list, and our next pick comes courtesy of Zach, our honorary pod boy. We're going to be talking about Mirrors by Alexander Aja.
I'm shaking my head.
Aja is a well-beloved director on this podcast. We always...
Piranha is a masterpiece.
Piranha, Oxygen recently covered. That was already like 3 years ago. Oxygen we covered. Crawl.
Oh, yeah, Crawl. I love Crawl.
Yeah.
I like Crawl.
Yeah, we're going to see what Aja did with Mirror Ghosts and Kiefer Sutherland.
Well, I've seen it.
You've seen it. I have not.
I haven't either.
So it'll be a first-time viewing for me. So that'll be next week's episode. One of these days I'll remember to refill the sponsors.
Please, if the Ashman started a small business, what would it be? Can you do an ad spot for them?
Oh, okay. The Ashman started a small business. I figured it would be in the voice of the Ashman.
Oh, I thought you were going to do an ad for his business.
I did, as the Ashman.
Oh, okay.
I think his business would be one of those cash for gold places. The Ashman's cash man for gold.
That's what I said. You just couldn't understand it.
Ash, cash, or grass.
Or
no one ash, rides for free.
Ash, cash, or gash, man.
Asses to asses, butts to butts.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Well, that'll bring us to the end of this week's episode, dear listener. If you like the show, don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you're listening to this to help us work our way up in the numbers and get into more people's algorithms.
It's rookie numbers. Pump those numbers up.
You gotta pump those numbers up. Those rookie. You can also support us on Patreon at patreon.com/podpeoplepod. Shout out to our honorary pod boys, Sam, Zach, Micah, and Mitchell. If you want to join them,
Everyone there is having a blast.
Yeah, we have lots of fun. Lots of fun on our Discord. If you become an honorary pod boy, you get to pick movies that we talk about, like next week's episode. If you like the show, consider supporting us that way. And of course, you can always follow us at letterboxd.com/podpeoplepod, where you can find a whole list of all the films we've talked about on the show with our average ratings and links to those reviews. For my extracurricular review this week, I've really been enjoying the new season of Tokyo Vice. I feel like I recommended that a while ago when the first season was airing, but season 2 is airing right now weekly on Max. If you want a gritty Tokyo crime drama based on a true story, executive produced by Michael Mann.
That sounds sick.
It's very good. It's very good. I've really been enjoying it. Ken Watanabe is in it, and yeah. Who doesn't love Ken Watanabe?
Yeah, he's great. Well, it feels a little redundant, but my recommendation for the week is watch Baba Yaa. Watch The Cat with Hands. Watch all of Robert Morgan's other shorts. They're all pretty short, and they're good.
They really are.
Earnestly,
freaks in them.
A lot of little freaks. Yeah. Morphing into other nasty little freaks and then gorping and bleeding and being all wretched.
Yeah. Press that play button on Baba Yaa.
Yeah.
Maybe even like and subscribe. Right.
What do you got, Clave?
I have something I also previously mentioned on the podcast. My shout-out this week is going to be to Angel's Egg. If you're looking for a beautiful allegorical piece about, I guess I could say a beautiful allegory, about creation and life and discovery, I would highly recommend it. It's a really beautiful film, not too long, and it's available on YouTube. You can just find it right there. But some of the art is absolutely astounding in it.
I wonder what drugs they were on when they made Angel's Egg.
I could do to be on some more drugs, I tell you what. All right, folks. Have a good night.
Good night.